Welcome to the Python Perspective. Since its premiere in October 1969, Monty Python's Flying Circus has induced alienation and devotion, culminating in 2014 with what was announced as 10 final live performances in the 16,000-seat O2 Arena. On the 50th anniversary of each original television broadcast, we look back at the series and ask, what was innovative material then, what continues to be successful now, and what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me is my co-host Nathan, physicist, improv comedian, and actor. Welcome back, Nathan.
Good to be back, Ben. This is a really cool experience, season two. A little bit delayed from the 50-year schedule, but I'm glad we're doing it all the same.
The original episode of the premiere of the second series of Monty Python's Flying Circus aired on the 15th of September in 1970 at 10:10 p.m. We're recording this on International Podcast Day, and we don't yet have a set schedule as to when it's going to come out. But I do think that the fun synergy of the fact that we are recording a podcast on opposite sides of the coast of the United States about something that aired on BBC One 50 years ago is a fitting tribute to the concept of International Podcast Day. So it feels apropos, even if it's not on the actual anniversary.
Indeed.
And our competitor podcast, the Python Up the Misses podcast, has now surpassed us. They were slightly behind us on the first series, but now I believe they are two or three episodes into series two. So we really need to work to catch up with them and make sure that our recap podcast beats them to the finish line.
Okay. I think that's a fair challenge. A fair challenge, my friend.
So series two, episode one. They had, as we discussed last series, stopped officially titling their episodes. The titles that are given to the episodes now are mainly for the video releases and a way of organizing things. In the official BBC press, if you look at the All the Words volume, or if you look at the publication notes that are reproduced in Network's Monty Python's Flying Circus show notes by Andrew Pixley, these episodes don't have names, but this is generally referred to as Face the Press.
I have always thought that if one were coming new to Python, you definitely serve yourself well to watch the movies first, at least Holy Grail and perhaps Life of Brian, just because that's what everyone remembers. Mm-hmm. But once you get past that and you want to delve a little deeper into the shows, I think season two is a better start than season one.
Interesting.
For whatever reason, it just rings more funny to me. And as I was going through these episodes, I actually found it difficult to check off my three favorite sketches. Some episodes, they're all favorites, but that's just a note. I've had discussions with other Python aficionados, and they've said it's probably a little bit more accessible than the sort of zany madcap humor of season one.
Interesting. I think that this episode is particularly strange in that it structurally is exceptionally similar to the first aired episode of the first season, which we remember was not the first recorded episode of the first season, but it has the same essential structure of a single long unit, a mockumentary, as the closing half of the episode with sketches beforehand, and it actually being sort of low on individual material. But it introduces one of the most iconic Python images, sketches, and concepts of all time in this episode. And the second episode in the series does the same. So they do hit the ground running with memorable Python, iconic Python moments. So I think your thesis holds a lot of water in that it's a good introduction in that it brings an audience straight to their greatest hits.
Yeah. But of course, they couldn't have known that at the time they were doing it.
Correct.
It just turned out that way.
Interestingly enough, this happens, the airing of this episode happens after the Pythons had gathered to record their first album. It was released in November of 1970 and is an official BBC recording, and they hated the process. Palin writes in his diaries about it being a very unhappy thing, and one of the reasons why they went on to have their further albums released with a private record company instead of through the BBC, which they felt majorly mishandled the thing. So they were already starting to get in the mindset of what do we need to do in order to package ourselves. They were starting to think about what were the greatest hits of the first season. So yes, they clearly didn't know what were going to be the greatest hits of the second season, but they were in that sense of thinking about when this is over, we're going to want to take our best bits and turn them into something, which is, of course, what led to, and now for something completely different, it's what led to the licensing of the shows for an American audience. All of that comes out of them starting to think about what are the best ways to represent Python outside of people who have caught us live or in repeat.
I think it's clear that there's definitely a lot more evident fan base that's cropping up even during the production of season two.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really speak to the budget of the show and what they were given in terms of resources, but you would not have been able to pay for all those extras of the gas cooker fix-it guys standing 30, 40 people long if there weren't fanboys or groupies or whatnot just lining up waiting to be picked to be in the background. Also, if you watch any of the filmed bits where they do in downtown London, they just did a kind of a poor job of getting people to not look straight at the camera. On a number of occasions, there's plenty of people just like walking right behind Cleese as he's doing his silly walks and just kind of gawking at the camera and chuckling.
It's one of my favorite moments.
A tiny bit distracting, but you don't really see that in season one where they were a little bit more under the radar. Well, a lot more under the radar, much less known.
The list of people who played the various members of the gas cooker organization, the various men in tan coats that stretch along the line, they're not just extras. They're not just fanboys. They're people who are regular character actors in the BBC. In Daryl Larson's Complete All the References, he has under the entry for Line of Gas Men what feels like a murderer's row of names that I don't recognize. But after each name, he lists something that they tend to be day players in. So we've got people who are in Doctor in the House, people who are in Z Cars, people who are in Dixon of Doc Green, in UFO, in Doctor Who. So I think that these were the men that were lining the backgrounds of the other shows that were in production at the BBC. I kind of hope that you're right, that they were fans of Python, that this generation of old men sort of thought that what was going on was new and exciting, and they were happy to join in with these young bucks. I don't have any way of knowing, but they all showed up and gamely stood in line streaking through the streets of actual London, which is a great visual and a wonderful running gag in the episode.
Sure. I still think there is a chance that because they knew it was a Python shoot, they would have not dropped what they were doing, but willingly showed up and be patient for the, I don't know, 2-3 hours of setup and production of just what is essentially two opposite takes from the front and from the behind.
Yeah, you're right. It really is only just there are three shots. There's the end of the gas cooker sketch itself, which leads into Gilliam's animation.
Mm-hmm.
There's the introduction of the Ministry of Silly Walks when John Cleese walks out of the corner shop. And then there's one more shot where Eric Idle's character from Doug and Dinsdale Piranha is being interviewed, and he's standing in front of a line of gas cooker men there as well. I think those are the only three. I don't remember a fourth.
Okay.
So you said you had a hard time coming up with three favorite sketches. I put it to you that that's in part because there are so few sketches in the actual show. There are basically five. But did you feel that there was a theme to the episode, or was it half and half structure of four basic sketches and then an extended mockumentary sequence that has a bunch of mini moments in it? Did that sort of defy the opportunity for anything to emerge as what might have been on their minds?
So my take on episode one is it is a little bit of almost a political satire.
Okay.
Or if you like, a satire on what I understand as a over bureaucratic sense of Britain at the time.
Mm.
So the gas cooker sketch, just to name one, the whole sketch centers around just the idiocy of all these silly laws, rules, and sort of like red tape that one has to go through to connect up a piece of household hardware that one has already purchased. And there's not really any question about that, but the complexity that is really unnecessary that they're sort of poking fun at. So in modern 2020 America, I would say that is not people's normal experience. So I'm kind of a little extemporizing to say that that's how it was necessarily in Britain. But I could see that it would be. And this fleet of fix-it guys, none of whom add any value to the discussion between the sellers and the buyer, amplifies the weighing down of the purchasing or capitalist system that they have in England in 1970.
Oh, but you'd have to fill out a temporary dispatch note, wouldn't
you? Yeah, we could leave it on a temporary dispatch note.
Well, that's sorted out then. Yeah. What a mess, isn't it?
Oh, no, it's ridiculous, really, but there you are.
So much of it seems to be about geography. A lot of the little pop-in bits that the men standing in the doorway add is, well, isn't that because of this location?
No, that's from Aerial Service at Reading.
No, Cheltenham, isn't it?
No, not this side of the street.
Well, what about London office?
No, I've got the machinery.
What, the Hounslow Depot?
Ah, they're still on standard pressure.
Same with Twickenham.
Which gives you the impression that the bureaucracy is so hyper-localized that whether you're an odd or an even-numbered house could affect whether or not you get service today or tomorrow or in 10 days.
There are also things that I just can't understand exactly what that is they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Like the S42.
Oh, yes. One or more person overcome by fumes, you'd have head office open round here.
Really?
Yeah, that's murder, you see.
Mm. Or suicide.
No, that's S42.
Oh. Kind of like the M1, MI5 are things a person in England would just like recognize. But to me, I have to kind of think about it. So S42... I don't know if that's just a random series of alphanumeric characters they came up with, or is it actually something somebody in 1970 would understand? Again, this ties back to the theme we had for last season, where something can become zany madcap humor when it's lost its all contextual significance. And I think a little bit of that might be coming through here, because we obviously don't know what it's like to buy a gas cooker in 1970 England, nor do we know what the organized crime situation was in England and in London at that time. I would say that a lot of the context is lost, so I don't really get exactly why it's being satirical, but I do still find it funny. So the zany madcap humor metamorphosis has almost reached its conclusion, so I'm just watching, oh, this is just silly nonsense that we're watching.
It does strike me as the kind of thing that it would be easy for a satirist to take his individual experience of, good Lord, it's so obnoxious that I tried to buy this thing and I couldn't get it to happen in any sort of efficient way. I know, I'll stick it to the man by writing a sketch about how convoluted the bureaucracy about just buying a simple appliance is. That's, you know, that feels fairly ordinary in terms of when you're trying to feed the beast of writing a weekly zany madcap show, you're going to take things that are part of an ordinary life and turn it into something that is big and boisterous and over the top in order just either to purge it from your personal experience or because you're looking to take the mundane and show how secretly weird it is.
Yes, I'll just put a button on that.
Yeah, just looking at the script in the volume of all the words, most of the things that they say are just numbers, giving the idea that there's just a thousand different forms. And one form in particular might be acceptable here, but not acceptable there. So they talk about the 290 and the 478, and the geographic locations is the service area at Reading, no Cheltenham, the Hounslow Depot, no, that's Twickenham. It's very much about little tiny differences in geography or simple numbers. I don't know. I in general find that the... perhaps the second to last button on that sketch where Michael Palin's character says,
well, what is it now? 11:30, murder. They'd be round here by two.
Oh, well, that's wonderful.
The idea that it would take that long for somebody to respond to their product having been involved in killing someone, and that, but they're all quite pleased that she'll only have been dead for 2.5 hours by the time they get here to hook up the gas. That's quite acceptable versus the 10 days to return it in the first place.
It's nice to see that. So this is a Jones Palin sketch, though to me it feels much more like Cleese and Chapman.
Interesting.
Just because it seems to be more about the words. Mm. And less about the setting, which I identify the appropriate writing pairs that way.
Well, see, whereas I don't find it to be vocabulary based, I find it to be situational. that it's very verbal. And so I understand why somebody would think that. But the fact that Palin is lead and that the other people really don't have anything to do in the sketch always made me think that it was very clearly a Palin jag that the others didn't quite understand how to make work.
But contrast that with the Piranha Brothers and Ethel the Frog,
mm-hmm.
which is written by Cleese Chapman, most of it on film, mockumentary feel, which I would associate normally with Palin Jones.
Mm.
So to me, the two writing pairs, I wouldn't say have switched, but maybe they have taken a page from the other's playbook. Feels like, okay, maybe they're just breaking out of their normal comfort zone.
Now, I do acknowledge that it is widely documented that John and Graham wrote Ethel the Frog, but it is odd because I do feel like going all the way back to the funniest joke in the world, which is the parallel super long sketch that opens the first series.
Sure.
That was very much a combination of little sketches thrown throughout, that they do the interrogation sketch within that, or they do the cops busting into the building to retrieve the joke, and they do the testing of the joke in wartime conditions. Each one of those is a tiny moment within it, and those all felt like very different kinds of sketches within the umbrella. And I assumed that therefore, with a full 13 minutes of screen time for Ethel the Frog, that there would be a similar version of an additive quality where the other writers would have contributed. But it really doesn't feel like it. It does, in fact, feel like a solid, you know, third of the program is just a Cleese Chapman sketch, which is interesting as a power play without knowing what actually happened behind the scenes. But especially also because Cleese has said in many interviews that as early as season two, Chapman was already starting to be the lesser partner in their relationship, that his alcoholism had taken him so much at this point that he was not consistent in being able to contribute.
Interesting.
Do we want to talk a little bit about the Piranha Brothers, since you said that we as occupants of 2020 don't necessarily walk around having a good concept of gangland London? Are you interested in learning about the Cray twins?
And this was this is a direct Cray Brothers kind of ripoff, I assume.
There are really particular one-to-one parallels in some of the things. I did find a BBC interview with the Crays, which I find fascinating, that there were these gentlemen who are, you know, acknowledged criminals sitting down in a BBC studio with their lawyer and in jackets and ties and acting very civilly.
Can you tell me why, during the trial, you didn't give evidence?
Well, we were advised by legal people not to give evidence.
Why was that?
Well, the law of this country is well established. The onus is on the prosecution to prove its case.
And being interviewed like they were just any other guest. There's a real extraordinary Britishness to the whole scenario if we are all going to pretend that we are gentlemen in this interview room and we're going to talk seriously about what you have or haven't done, but we're also not going to be salacious about it. We're going to expect that everyone is above board. It's really quite a fascinating document.
Okay, interesting.
And so that footage, I think, would have been part of the background for the creation of the Ethel the Frog documentary. What about the construction or the characters of that sketch did you appreciate?
I find the most humor, I laugh the most when I'm watching John Cleese be his anchor newsman, stiff brow kind of guy. And also I enjoy when I watch Terry Jones interviewing somebody, which happens. Maybe it's because they're the straight men either saying something ridiculous or they're the straight men interviewing someone who's ridiculous.
So part of what you enjoy is a realistic presentation of something where the language or the phrasing or the cadence that they use reveals that this should be normal, but they're talking about things that are absurd.
That's right.
So to have, I don't actually remember who first introduces the concept of Spiny Norman.
The hedgehog.
Is it John Cleese's female impersonator who says that he's paranoid about being watched.
Yes.
And so just the very idea that somebody seated at this bar in the seedy surroundings would say,
Dinsdale was a perfectly normal person in every way. Except inasmuch as he was convinced that he was being watched by a giant hedgehog, he referred to as Spiny Norman.
Is not at all the kind of sentence that you expect to come out of a serious-minded documentary about violence. And is that contrast of the very serious, very somber presentation of this with the words that are just absurd, is that part of the gem?
Yeah. So I'm gonna go back a little bit on what I said earlier.
Okay.
Because I do find I get a lot of pleasure when I watch Stig O'Tracy, played by Graham Chapman, with a huge scar on his face. Just the things that he says offhand that are typical gangster behavior, that he would take him round for a scrape.
And Dinsdale said, "Oh, you've been a naughty boy, Clement." And he splits me nostrils open and saws me leg off and pulls me liver out.
Those little hiccups in what is clearly not any one who's listening to this, their daily life, those are also really enjoyable. And also the Eric Idle character, who kept on raving about how awesome the Piranha Brothers were.
Old Dinsy!
Yeah, old Dinsy. That guy, what is his name? Where he's like, yeah, they punished me, and they never told me why, but...
But he gave me his word that it was the case, and that's good enough for me with old Dinsy.
So I like both, I suppose. Both the zany characters and also the interviewers.
I think that Eric Idle's character might be Stig O'Tracy, and I think Graham Chapman's character might be Vince Snetterton Lewis, if my notes are correct.
Right. You are correct.
Because I can hear Eric Idle's voice doing, "Oh, I had transgressed the unwritten law," the way in which he turns law into a two or and a half syllable word.
One thing about Python that I really enjoy is every now and again, I will hear a line that I always want to use in my daily life.
Yes.
And this skit has one of them, which is...
This, for the Piranha Brothers, was the turning point.
Because just at the end of that whole, the operation, the other operation, the other operation, such like an infantile discovery of how to phrase the threat. I don't know, every single time, it's hilarious.
Mm.
It's also the kind of joke which does not have a really abrupt punchline. You have to listen to the first two descriptions of the operation, the other operation, then the other operation, and then in your mind work out, sort of back calculate, neither of those two made sense, but okay, I get it. It takes a little bit more cerebral engagement from the listener.
Especially because nothing's happening on the screen.
Zilch.
Except John Cleese telling this.
Yes.
Yeah, it is all audio. It's all you participating in understanding what he isn't saying correctly.
Well, since we're talking about this sketch and its sheer length, I'm going to put a pin in that and say that that is one of my favorite sketches.
Ah. I mean, you'd be hard-pressed not to have it, considering it is one third of the show in length and one sixth of the show in sketches. So,
yes.
If you didn't like it, you'd really hate this episode.
Even the line, like when basically they set off a thermonuclear warhead in the middle of West London, and they say even the police began to sit up and take notice, is kind of a stab at the system. So that sort of threads a little bit into how this might be satirical.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it does give a, considering that this is based on actual gangsters at the time that had just been convicted, it feels like a pretty salty punch towards the direction of what it took for law enforcement to perhaps move against the craze in the first place.
I will say you don't see a whole lot of Gilliam in this episode.
No.
And I think probably the reason is he spent all his time doing the Spiny Norman animations. I think it's the first time, you can probably correct me on this, it's the first time that live action and cartoon elements were overlapped. I don't know how technically difficult that is to do, but it is a thing that happened. I did notice that.
Yeah, because you do have Spiny Norman being overlaid on the city streets with people, real people moving underneath.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you and I have way back in the day with a Super 8 camera, tried to make our own Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles stop-motion animation with paper cutouts.
I remember.
And that was a total failure. We were not technically at the level of Terry Gilliam at all. We were punching way above our belt there. That's not the expression, but you know what I mean. The basic idea of, if you've got film at 24 frames per second, then you can literally draw on top of each frame. I think that's how they did the special effects in Highlander originally. They basically did drawing on the photography. So it is a painstaking process, and I think probably why it's so short with Dinsdale and the city of London, because that couple of seconds, if it's 24 frames per second, and they actually did all 24 frames, just think about how many incremental drawings that would have been to overlay.
Mm-hmm. How do you take the Harry Snapper organs as being a closet thespian? Does that fit in with the critique of the Q division of the time that took so long to take the craze down?
Less that and more a potentially interesting take on the cop that brought them in the first place, who turned into kind of a minor celebrity. So let me give you a little bit of what Larson gives us about the inspiration for Snapper Organs, who also had a ridiculous nickname, the real individual. Larson tells us that the policemen who doggedly led the investigation of the craze from 1964 through their first major arrest and trial in 65 was Detective Chief Inspector Leonard Nipper Reed. And his nickname was played up in the tabloids at the time, was based on the fact that he had been a boxer. The Snapper Organs thing is kind of it's two letters off from Nipper. It's hardly much of a change. Larson also thinks that there's some overlap there in the continued poking fun at Sergeant Norman Pilcher, who we brought up in the planting of the drugs. That's a sandwich. Oh no, what did I give to the wife cop? Mm-hmm. Who they thought was a terrible jerk who had a hard on to try and arrest celebrities. And so that very concept of a stuffed shirt policeman who has eyes above his station, I think, is what Larson is attributing here. I think that there's just something funny about a policeman who's so enraptured with the idea of going undercover that he turns it into an acting career. And that's where primarily the joke lies, is that he gets distracted so much away from actually trying to arrest them and instead has to create a long and convoluted repertory acting career in order to go from place to place.
I tracked them to Cardiff, posing as the Reverend Smiler Egret. Hearing they'd gone back to London, I assumed the identity of a pork butcher, Brian Stokes. On my arrival in London, I discovered they had returned to Cardiff.
Do you think that that's a good gag? I mean, because it is sort of the end of the episode, is the trailing off of the news clippings, what I think is a fantastic gag of that his performance was ruined by him striding on stage and shouting, now then, what's all this then? completely out of character, is a very funny bit. But then to cut to Snapper getting ready and made up backstage before they come out of the police station into the streets.
Never mind, Snapper, love, you can't win them all.
True, Constable, could I have my eyeliner, please?
Is very much not an ending. And the Pythons are usually quite good at not endings. But that feels like both filler and like they were building towards something and then didn't go there.
I don't know if they were building much of anything at that point. I don't know. I suspect that Graham Chapman was still closeted at that point in his career, at least publicly. And I swear I heard this, but I really couldn't find any reference for it. But at the time, you could not legally put on television a gay character who was not outlandishly ridiculous, basically to sort of make them seem like caricatures of themselves.
Mm.
But I do find that a cringeworthy moment. Any time they have characters like that on stage, either played by Graham or pretty much anyone else, usually Terry Gilliam, it feels kind of, I don't like it. I'm not really quite sure they were really on board with having it go very far. But that's just my, 2020 interpretation.
No, it's very interesting and relevant on a couple of different levels. One, because we're interested in what has aged well and badly. And so the fact that they have that, plus Graham at the beginning in the pink Diamante collar and dress as the representative on one side of the debate in Face the Press, mm-hmm. We really do have a bookend of a kind of Faye Graham being presented to the audience. They are leaning in that direction quite strongly in this episode. And the question is was it funny at the time, and why does it make us so uncomfortable now? I mention this in part because today's New York Times, and I recognize that it's no longer today's New York Times when this episode comes out, but talks about a forthcoming streaming performance of a revisitation of a play called The Boys in the Band. And The Boys in the Band was written in 1969 in response to a challenge to have gay characters be on stage and have their lives be real and realistic. And one of the analyses that I read today on NPR by Glenn Weldon talked about how he saw that the updating of the play today does show that the campness, the fayness of the portrayals of gay life, which was being done in 69 to be as accurate as possible, has turned into something that we now find to be a little over the top and cliche as we continue to search for gay representation that shows that people don't need to be performative in their gayness. So I think that is some of the tension that we're seeing here in the revival of Boys in the Band, where they keep the script intact. They are performing outdated modes or trying to find current truths in those modes. But we're seeing that high wire act of what is acceptable. What, if the BBC's remit is to educate, inform, and entertain, and to not have things that are considered bad replicable, one of the worst ways in which you can have an 18 rating in a movie, according to the BBFC, is to have replicable violence. Violence that somebody could imitate in a way that could seriously harm, and done in such a way that it's shown as being cool and awesome and therefore would encourage the viewers to accidentally cause harm to somebody else. I feel like what you read about the possible portrayal of homosexuality falls under that same remit. There may well have actually been a thing out there that said you can't portray being gay as at all positive because it might encourage people to replicate it. We haven't been able to find that document, but that's why I believe that you read something like that, because it falls in the type of thing that the BBC would have and still does do.
Yes. A similar character is at the start of the Gaskiger sketch.
Mm-hmm.
I think his name, sadly, is Kill the Japs Forster.
Yes.
Who is nothing but that. It is a taped on the television version of John Cleese on a lounge chair in a big pink frilly dress, talking in that very camp way.
Hello, sailors! Listen, guess what? The Ministerette of Aviation has made me head of the RAF Ola Pola.
Mm-hmm.
So they hit that button a few times, I think, probably maybe more, in this episode.
Yeah, and I really do hope that this was being done with Graham as an instigator, that he was doing this in part because he was trying to get a certain kind of flamboyance out on the airwaves in order to help normalize it, that this wasn't him acting out in a way. My suspicion is that everybody in Python knew that he was gay, and that this was a way of him making it more and more public in some small manner. But it does feel distasteful from a modern perspective.
Yeah. Do we have anything else you want to say about Ethel the Frog?
I have a note here to research how long a hedgehog actually is, which I did not do, because it's described that he's variously 12 feet from snout to tail, up to a full 800 yards long. And I wanted to find out what a good metric was for what 800 yards was and how much bigger than a real hedgehog that would be. But did not do any of that.
Well, that is 8 football fields length. If a football field is 100 yards, that is 8 of them.
This is American football, of course.
Yes, this is gridiron or American football, depending upon which British colony country you listen from.
Just briefly touching on the issue of representation of homosexuality and specifically about the echoes of that with the Krays is when you have the interviews about the piranhas, one of the questions is, you know, what was Dinsdale Piranha really like? And the answer is that he has an interest in boys' associations.
He took a warm interest in boys' clubs, sailors' homes, choristers' associations, scouting jamborees, and of course, the household cavalry.
And then it ends with the royal family's bodyguard. And it's a strange joke to sort of play on the idea that, well, first of all, to conflate pederasty and homosexuality, which is always a dangerous association, but then to twist the knife at the very end and say that the special guard of the royal family is the rough equivalent to the kind of place where men would seek to take advantage of younger men in order to convert them to being gay, is a very strange joke and one that I don't think necessarily worked then, except that there is a giggle about it on the soundtrack.
Is there anything unusual?
That's my last note, only because it is relevant to the tone of a movement of what is acceptable and funny in the portrayal of that aspect of life at the time. What other sketches out of the 6 met your top 3?
Oh, since we've brought it up already, I am going to say the new gas cooker sketch.
That must be the new gas cooker!
It has a very strange start.
Mm.
It's not too often that you have the start of a sketch actually showing... Well, actually, it starts a couple of times. I should backtrack a little bit. It starts first with Cherry Jones sitting in a living room, and she gets a knock on her door, to which Terry Gilliam, with a hatchet through his head wearing a clown suit, names the wrong woman, and her reaction is, oh, I must be in the wrong house.
Right.
And then takes a full minute of not sped up film footage to crawl out of that house, go over a wall, and then into the neighboring house.
Which is a weirdly memorable moment for some people. There's a black and white still of Terry Jones in drag as Mrs. Pinnett climbing over the wall that is frequently used in publications. And I don't know what it is about that. The weirdness of Terry Jones' hairy legs as he swings them over the wall between the gardens, whether it's because backyard gardens are so much part of everyday English life that they like the transgressiveness of climbing into somebody else's gardens, or whether they just like Terry Jones as a pepper pot and that's who they most associate him with, and so this was a big still image. But I see it reproduced in Python retrospectives all the time for what is such a strangely quiet minute, as you say, real-time activity.
My guess is they were short 1 minute. Is honestly my guess, because you and I have talked at length about how funnier things are, how more funny the film is if it's sped up, which would have dropped it down to maybe 15 seconds or less. But they didn't do that. So a full minute really adds up and could space it out to the full length of 31 minutes and change. It doesn't really get a whole rouse from the audience. It's not funny to me as the viewer. But you're right. It does tend to have this lingering after effect, kind of bronzed, I suppose, by that photo of him with his legs parched. You can sort of see up his skirt. As like, oh, this is an archetypal Python moment. And it's really not, but that photo has made it seem that way.
But then we get the Ben-Hur-esque titles, which are literally described in the script as letters like Ben-Hur overlaid over the scene that says the gas cooker sketch. And we have had a couple of times of like people referring to this is going to be a sketch, but it's been a minute. First of all, it's been a break in between series, but also it's been a little bit since they were that much on the nose about we're acknowledging that this is a show that we're putting on. They haven't done that in a while, and so that was fun as a good way of amping up the artificiality of what they're about to do.
I wonder if it had something to do with the audio cut. So they have the graphic, the sort of two-point perspective, quasi-three-dimensional, the gas cooker sketch with coupled with this very orchestral, over-the-top, demonstrative, like, blah, 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 only to have it cut, like, mid-note. Very awkward. My initial reaction was not like, oh, they made a mistake. It was more that, okay, they're just letting you know in this kind of subtle audio rejection that this is not what they're building up to. They're not building up to something magnanimous and huge. It's just a comedy sketch.
So then we get the gentleman starts off with just two, just Michael and Graham.
Mm-hmm.
And right off the bat, they say, is this the wrong address? They're looking for Circle, whatever the address is, Circle instead of Road.
Crescent.
Yeah, Crescent. Thank you.
This is 46 Edging on Crescent.
No, Road. Edging on Road.
Road, yeah, it says here. Yeah.
But they're like, oh yeah, on the form, it does say Road. We said it wrong. But it starts off very quickly, very subtly, to give you the indication that there's already the potential for confusion. And then they plow straight into the idea that, well, this is definitely the gas cooker I ordered, and it's my address, and it's Mrs. G, but I'm Mrs. G. Pinnett, not Mrs. G. Crump.
Well, it says Crump here, done it, Harry.
Yeah, it's on the invoice.
Yeah, it's definitely Crump.
Mm-hmm.
And then it becomes about bureaucracy. It's about, well, we can't do this because the form tells us what we can and can't do. Which is a huge theme that Gilliam comes back to in Brazil, which he co-wrote with his frequent collaborator Charles McCune and with playwright Tom Stoppard. And there's so much in Brazil about paperwork and bureaucracy ruining things.
Mm.
There's a whole extended bit with trying to get the ducts fixed in the main character's apartment. And you can't do that because you don't have the right form. And so Bob Hoskins refuses to do it correctly. So Robert De Niro's character, a rogue man, comes in and fixes his ducts for him. And we also have the attempt to arrest somebody, which gets screwed up because a fly falls in a typewriter. And so the wrong keystroke gets a SWAT team to burst into the wrong person's house and imprison him. And then it's all about the paperwork. Well, we've got this paper that says it's him. Who are we to trust, the person or the paperwork?
Mm-hmm.
Is exactly the theme of this sketch.
We've seen the character before with the trench coat and the paperboy hat in the last series as being a flasher.
Mm.
And I don't know if that is a thinly veiled attempt to label government workers as all being flashers. None of them do flash, but it was... Mm. I forget which episode it was, but it's the one where Terry Jones is walking on the street flashing people and people will have like a immediate frightened response, but all he's wearing is a sign that says boo, but it's the same costume. And I personally do not get the paperboy hat, the glasses, and the trench coat assembly. It does look odd.
Yeah, I can't obviously totally speak to this, but I think the that image of the man in the dirty Mac... the Macintosh, which is what that particular type of trench coat is called, continues on. He shows up in our previous episode about the first episode of Rutland Weekend Television in the music video for The Man in the Dirty Movies. We have the Dirty Mac Brigade, and we've got that passel of five or six disgusting men walking through all the porn films, because that's what you wear. Not just to cover up the fact that you're potentially not wearing anything underneath it, that you have legs of trousers hooked up to a suspender belt, but nothing actually around your groin. But it also gives you the opportunity to touch yourself without somebody else being able to notice by putting your hand through your pocket. That's the main mechanics, as I understand it, of the purpose of a giant Macintosh coat and why it became associated with people who were disgusting. Not to put too much judgment on it. So we're supposed to be porn forward in 2020, but I'm not there yet.
So it is a little bit of a dig.
Or potentially one of the reasons why somebody would have worn a Macintosh coat to be a flasher was because it was anonymous. because it was what everybody wore. And so therefore to have this uniform of this is what a person coming to install your cooker or a person coming to check the gas or the oil or the electricity would have worn in a rain heavy environment. A flat cap and a Macintosh would have just been what you wore. And therefore, if you wanted to not be noticed, if you wanted to be anonymous until you whipped out your old fella in front of a bunch of young teenagers, that was what you would have worn as well to be unsuspicious at first.
Okay. I want to wrap up this particular favorite sketch just by noting I've never understood. It always has slightly bugged me that it is just one of Nate's pet peeves. Why does he take the tube of gas from the cooker? That doesn't make any sense to me. Shouldn't it be from the wall? do gas stoves come with a tank of a finite amount of propane or methane or whatever? Well, that's it. Once it's done, you got to get a new gas cooker.
Right. If there's a tank of gas in the cooker, then you don't need to hook it up, do you?
No, you do not.
But I think you're right. I think it's just a way of destroying the reality of the sketch for a punchline.
We're actually going in reverse order here. So my this is actually my number one, just because I watched it first, is Face the Press.
Nathan, I'm severely disappointed in you.
Yes, I'm sure you are, but I have my reasons.
Well, then I will populate my five favorite moments almost entirely from the I'd Like Some Pram, Please sketch.
Pram for sale. Any offers? I'd like a bit of pram, please.
Yes, that's in good condition.
Oh, good. I like them in good condition. Hey.
Because that, for me, is the absolute highlight of this episode. I know everybody else is going to say, why aren't we talking about the Ministry of Silly Walks? Because it is the most famous, and there are some hilarious bits within it. But my God, man. Eric Idle being a... Speaking of Dirty Mac Brigade, speaking of creepy porn... How can you not love a short get-in, get-out sketch where he just basically does the nudge-nudge man, except grosser, with a mustache, a different kind of mustache, and says a bunch of things in a salacious voice that wouldn't be funny if he wasn't reading them that way? Nobody else could say,
I'd like to give some blood, please. Whoa!
And make it funny, except Eric Idle. It's genius. It's genius.
Now, Ben, my good
friend.
I want
you to change your list, Nate.
I did say.
Change your list,
Nate. I did forewarn you. I had a difficult time narrowing down, because there a lot of them would top my favorite sketches of a different show. But... Why do I like Face the Press? Well, I think...
Yes, thank you. That's what I should have asked. I apologize.
Okay, so...
Nathan, why do you like Face the Press?
Tonight on Face the Press, we're going to examine two different views of contemporary things.
So I think it is three things. First of all, it is the seriousness of Eric Idle. A lot of the actors play those serious news types very well, but Cleese and Idle, I think, are tops, with Palin quite near the top as well. And who else could play the character of the representing the government dressed in a striking organza dress? And just the absurdity of what he is trying to do and introducing essentially to the audience that here we're going to talk about how inefficient, ineffective, and pointless governments making promises are. Or how pointless itself government is. You know, he wanted to build
88,000 million billion houses a year in the greater London area alone. In fact, you built only three in the last 15 years.
Which it does, like, as I say, it sounds odd to me because I never think of governments as lasting any more than 4 to 8.
Right.
Or even 2.
Right.
So this is it's a British thing that I don't really fully understand.
But does tie elegantly into the theme of wasteful bureaucracy in a very quick and subtle way, because it's not the focus of the episode, but at the same time, it is a brilliant second punchline in the sketch.
But just knowing that you're going to hear the silly high-pitched whine.
I'd like to answer this question, if I may, in two ways. Firstly, in my normal voice, and then in a kind of silly, high-pitched whine.
And you sort of lean in a little bit closer to the TV, and the camera is not on Chapman at all. It's
correct.
Purely on Idle. So you're just kind of like waiting for that. And that waiting, that anticipation, is why I like this sketch so much. It ramps it up. And then once you get it, it's really, really, it's very satisfying. Not to mention the fact that the entity making the case against the government, what clearly is not...
A small patch of brown liquid.
But is in fact just a patch of brown cloth made to look like a piece of brown liquid. they cut to it really quickly, and the audience gets a big laugh, which is funny because they would not have had the benefit of having a quick camera cut like that.
Right.
Either they were prompted to laugh when this cut was made, or they actually found it kind of amusing. And you can only really get that joke once if you're in the audience, because if they have to stop and retake, it's no longer funny. But all these things together just gives this sketch a little bit more momentum to push it over the top and to be in the favorite sketches pile.
You know what? You've convinced me, because while the the ad board with Idol is all about delivery, it's one joke delivered six times in a row. It's a damn good joke. It's a one-trick pony that I would definitely pay another 50 cents to ride again. But the... the joke density in Face the Press is extraordinary, because it starts off with the Striking Organs address, then it goes to the small patch of brown liquid, which may be creosote or maybe something else, and then moves on to the million billion houses. The brilliance of...
Are you a bit disappointed with this result?
Which is a line reading that they use again when they do the election night special with the Looney Party. Kevin Phillips Bong, they ask him, are you at all disappointed in this result? In that exact cadence, which really is wonderful. This is Idol tight as a drum in his writing, just spitting out a next absurdist line after a next absurdist line. The density is really quite great.
I accept your apology.
Let us move on to the Monty Python Minute, which today the good people at random.org have suggested that we revisit minute number 17.
But you know, kids were very different then. They didn't have their heads filled with all this Cartesian dualism.
At the age of 15, Doug and Dinsdale started attending the Ernest Pythagoras Primary School in Clerkenwell.
So Nathan has watched an isolated minute of the program, which he now has 30 seconds to summarize. If he fails to do this, nothing will happen. If he succeeds in doing this, well, I'll tell you what we did with Anna is we ended up, so you succeed, you get a bonus point on the trivia, which means you are one third of the way to getting the 3 points out of five necessary in order to win the quiz, for which you also get nothing.
What's funny about your podcast with Anna, I listened to those, and she sounds so broken up at the end that she didn't summarize everything, which is exactly how I feel when I can't do it. But the task is, it's like you're giving somebody some shoelace and say, go climb Everest with this, pal. So I'm not too concerned.
All right. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Your time begins now.
This is Ethel the Frog, where we have Eric Idle interviewing one of the Dinsdale brothers' neighbors when they were little, and she is this Pepper Pot who claims that this is a very violent neighborhood where people were stealing all their stuff, and modern kids have all their heads filled with like nonsense, modern like Cartesian dualism. And then it cuts to the schoolmaster that they went to school with at the Ernest Pythagorean schools, and he gives a non-verbal description of them doing something incredibly violent that includes blowing something's heads off and having their guts opened up by opening up the rib cage.
Time!
Oh, that's five. And Terry Jones does a very funny thing where he interviews with pointing the microphone in the wrong direction, which I love. And it actually gets out a fantastic humoristic effect. And all the people in the back who are watching the camera are very bemused.
Wait, this is anarchy. You just decided to keep going?
I heard five and I kept on going. I was going until you said cut.
No, I said time.
Oh, time.
Time, gentlemen, time. You're not wrong, though. That is a really, really good bit with Terry Jones interviewing Graham Chapman as the schoolmaster, and he keeps on pointing the microphone at the wrong person, and so there's no sound as they are gesticulating about the violent, terrible things the Piranha Brothers did to each other. It's a really funny bit.
Yeah.
However, that is not the basis of our quiz today. Our quiz is based on the throwaway line early on about the concept of Cartesian dualism.
Yes.
Question number one. Contrasting Plato and Descartes' dualist philosophies, which of the following is an untrue statement? A. Plato posits that ideas are substances and are the highest rung on the ontological ladder, whereas Descartes' ideas are the least real thing in the universe. Or B. While Plato consistently speaks of psyche or the soul, Descartes speaks of the spirit and the mind and the self as separate. Or C. In Descartes' Meditations, he refutes the allegory of the cave by claiming that one has comprehended the truth of what is not real through systemic doubt, and one has no responsibility to help others in the cave realize what is true. Which of those is not true?
I would say C is not true. It seems a little bit too advanced for Descartes.
Correct! Question number two. Descartes, in his work The World, attempts to explain all observable parahelia in the treatises on light, the treatise on man, and the treatise on the soul. What phenomenon would not have fallen under Descartes' scope? A sketch with Sandra Bullock on Muppets Tonight, where she sings Phenomenon to the tune of Menomina. B. John Travolta witnesses a beam of light and develops telekinetic powers in Phenomenon. Or C. Mary J. Blige performs Phenomenological with Jay-Z at the Emmys, which leads to her featuring on his single Can't Knock the Hustle.
I'm going to say with zero justification, B.
No, John Travolta does in fact star in a movie called Phenomenon where he develops telekinetic powers. Mary J. Blige did in fact do a bunch of that stuff, but as far as I know, wasn't based on a song called Phenomenological. Question number three.
Yeah.
Descartes' philosophy was inspired by three visions. Retroactive diagnosis has attributed what disorder to Descartes to explain the revelations that led to his dualist theories? A. TLE, or temporal lobe epilepsy, producing seizures that froze his body but left his consciousness intact. B. Hallucinations due to oxygen deprivation, a hypoxia caused by his Dutch military stove used in an enclosed space. Or C. EHS, or exploding head syndrome, where a person hallucinates vivid lights and sounds and strange electrical tinglings right before falling asleep or prior to waking up.
A.
Unfortunately, it was exploding head syndrome.
Bollocks.
I know, it sounds too ridiculous to be the real answer, but that's why I wrote that question. Question number four.
All right.
These four Frenchmen are mentioned in Monty Python as great thinkers: Pascal, Sartre, Voltaire, and Descartes. Put them in chronological order.
Okay. I would say Voltaire, Descartes, Pascal, and then Sartre.
Very close. Unfortunately, Voltaire was from 1694 to 1778, so he was third, but otherwise you got it correct. So if you hadn't put him first, you would have had it.
Okay.
Finally, there are a number of callbacks in this episode. Which of the following is not a callback to episode one of Python? A. Descartes, the I Think Therefore I Am animation. B. Luigi Vicardi selling the army protection and then showing up in Ethel the Frog. C. Brian Trabshaw and Jean-Brian Zapatatique perform the Anglo-French in this and are in Sheep Aviation.
La marche foutille?
Oui, merci. Or D, the psychologist who analyzes the psychology of the Piranha Brothers is in The Mouse Problem. Those four sketches, I Think Therefore I Am Animation, Selling the Army Protection, Sheep Aviation, and The Mouse Problem, which isn't in episode one?
I would say... Probably Vercati.
Correct. Luigi Vercati doesn't appear until episode 8 of the first series, whereas all the rest are in the first episode. So you got exactly 50% because you got most of question 4 correct, but not quite. So therefore, you got 2.5 out of 5, which is not a victory, but not a loss either. You're balanced on the knife edge of success.
All right. Well, this is, of course, is now our favorite Monty Python moments. Moments, to our listener, are small bits of film, acting, cartoon, or studio-taped bits, which are not a full sketch necessarily, but every time we see them, just make us smile. So, Ben, please give me your top first of five moment.
I actually found this episode to be more good on a moments scale than on a sketch scale. I thought that there was lots of brilliant tiny bits of creativity that did exactly what you describe. I'm going to start with a moment that I deliberately elided past when describing all of the tight punchlines in Face the Press. I think that the laugh that the audience gets when Eric Idle introduces the small patch of brown liquid for the opposition is hilarious, but even more hilarious, and which they don't laugh quite as hard at, is the genuine smile that he gives when he says good evening to the patch of brown liquid or creosote.
Good evening. Minister...
He acts the hell out of that moment. He is genuinely pleased that that fake patch of crap is there on the chair next to him. He greets it exactly like he would a real guest. I mean, Eric Idle's doing some key work in that scene anyway. His wig is doing an enormous amount of work. If you look at Eric Idle in the line of gas cooker men, I'm pretty sure that's his real hair. It's long and flowing, and he wears a bunch of different wigs in this episode that you really, at least I can't really tell, because they work really well on his head. They have a dynamite wig department in the BBC, and Eric is allowed to have his more free-flowing, post-hippie, rebel hair in real life and still look like a consummate professional on set. But he is also a consummate professional when he greets a bad prop with the sheer joy of actually being able to interview it. And it's a great moment. What about you? What's top on your list of possible five?
In the reappearance of the French speakers...
Maintenant, je vous présente, encore une fois, mon ami, le pauvre célèbre Jean Brun, Jean Apathique.
Ah oui!
Jean Brown, Jean Apathique, and Cleese, who is now somehow Brian Trebshaw. I didn't notice this the first many, many times I watched this, but I noticed it now when rewatching it. When Michael Palin indicates, avec la pied à gauche, avec la pied à droite, at that moment, Cleese actually indicates the wrong foot. And I thought that was delicious.
That is bizarre. I still haven't noticed that, but I will definitely go back and look for it the next time I watch it.
And also, since we're talking about this little moment, is he wearing a really bad dirty blonde wig, or is he wearing a clove of garlic?
I believe he's wearing cloves of garlic, yes.
Okay.
In order to up the Frenchness from their previous appearance in episode one, they have added a string of garlic around their necks to really, really drive home the stereotype.
Uh-huh.
Woof, woof, woof.
Okay.
We haven't talked about the Ministry of Silly Walks hardly at all, except to mention it.
You're really interested in silly walks, aren't you?
Oh, rather.
So I will just say, for my moment number three, that Cleese does a bang-up job of acting the truth of a government minister when he instantly is able to take Palin's walk and deconstruct it in a very clinical and descriptive way. And so to say that...
I mean, the right leg isn't silly at all, and the left leg merely does a forward aerial half turn every alternate step.
Is just a great piece of descriptive writing of, like, sitting down and trying to come up with how would this be described in a manual if you were to read it. But I also love the petulant socialist attitude of Mr. Pewdie saying...
Yes, well, I think with government backing, I could make it very silly.
Like, what a great aspiration for this character who's clearly just a knockoff version of Arthur Pewdie from the Marriage Counselor sketch. Just, he's pinned his hopes and dreams on, if I could just make my walk silly, that would solve all of my problems. Maybe Deirdre would come back to me. Maybe everything would be okay. He's such a miserable little sod.
I will say about this sketch, and part of the reason why I didn't put it on my top five is, like Crunchy Frog from season one, I thought the live version was funnier.
Interesting.
The one they do at the Hollywood Bowl is just a little bit funny. I think he's got his walk down a little bit more funny. I mean, he has the whole stage to move on versus the small, 2 meter by 2 meter.
It's definitely more flamboyant.
Yes. And I also think the Mrs. Two Lumps coming in, played by Carol Cleveland in the live show, is more funny than whoever it is they have it doing in the taped version on the show. I am fully aware that the bit about the Marsh for Teal is removed in the live version. We also don't have John Cleese flinging the entire projector off camera, which is a good gag. He just kind of gestures to the huge screen at the Hollywood Bowl, but that was my main point about the sketch, is that it just gets better with age, and since I've seen it in the 1982 Hollywood Bowl live show, I just like that that version a little bit better.
I believe the name of the actress who plays Mrs. Two Lumps is Daphne Davy.
Mm-hmm.
I specifically want to be able to shout her out because I believe she's not mentioned in the actual credits, which is unusual for a person who has a speaking line. Now, when she comes in, she doesn't talk, but there is a voice over the conference device on the desk. There is a voice, and so you would think that that would be enough to give her a credit, but mysteriously, there doesn't seem to be a listing for her at the end of the episode. So perhaps that was a different voice, and the splitting of the physical actor from the recorded voice may have prevented either of them from getting credit.
Moment number four, if I may.
Please.
Since we're talking about non-Python actors on the stage, I'm going to give a shout out to this man, Stanley Mason, who plays the little guy popping out from behind Idle and Cleese to say,
"Bill, I thought he was Hangold."
Which I don't really know what that means. But what I love about it is that he is the wrong size.
Mm.
If you listen to Rowan Atkinson's treatise on comedy, which I've referred to many times in previous episodes, he says things are funny if they're used in the wrong way or they're the wrong size.
Mm.
And this guy is the wrong size. He bursts in, kind of like you don't really see him, then all of a sudden he's there. And what he says is not necessarily immediately funny to me, but I just love how he just pops in there and says his line. Looking at his IMDb page, he was a juggler, acrobat, and circus performer, so all that training of timing and being small, I suppose, would have helped him out. He also makes another appearance in the Eric Idle going in for a prostitute sketch where they end up stealing some aftershave. I'm just going to give a shout out to that guy.
Nice.
Stanley Mason.
Thank you, Stanley.
And for the fifth moment, Ben.
Yeah, well, we've got to talk about Eric Idle trying to pick up a prostitute. It is, I mentioned it before, it's definitely the part. I mean, first of all, I was part of an online community for a number of years that was largely London-based, and there was a regular Mockney thing that they would do where they would type out the word that Idle says when he says, "I'd like to give some blood, please." He goes, "War!" And it's spelled F-W-O-O-O-A-R-R. And I was always indebted to them for taking that laddie bit of noise, that bit of innuendo, and turning it into something that I could use in a text. Not that I've ever had an occasion to do so, but I like the ability to know what that noise is in phonetic form. But also, just the marvelous desperation of that character to turn everything into innuendo.
Chest of drawers. Chest drawers. I'd like some chest of drawers, please.
Yes, sir.
Does it go?
And Terry Jones' refusal to acknowledge that any of it until at the very end when he produces the card and then he's looking awkwardly off, not making eye contact because it's so obvious. It's it's a delicious sketch altogether, but it's also the line, "I'd like some pram, please," is you talk about the phrases that you want to use in real life. "I'd like some fill-in-the-blank, please," done in a saucy... Take pretty much anything, and you say it in that sentence and that voice, making it hilariously sexual, is a nice tool to have in your holster, in my opinion.
I had this as my last favorite moment, too, so I'm happy that we finally agreed on something. This episode of Farced Perspective was conceived, researched, and performed by Ben Russell and Nathan Emley. Sound design also by the two of us.
The theme song is by John Philip Sousa and sourced by Creative Commons clips from the archive.org community.
Editing was done by Ben. You can find us at pythonperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at PythonPod. This podcast is an intellectual exploration of the comic phenomenon. Known as Monty Python's Flying Circus.
If there are things, dates, names, facts, mobsters, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website, and we'll post it to our errata page on farceperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Nathan, and my co-host is Ben.
Dinsdale!
We'll see you next time on Farced Perspective.